I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Today our guest is Dr. Scott Hughes. He's an emeritus professor of geology at Idaho State University, and he's made a career studying volcanoes here in Idaho, even on Mars. More on that in a bit. Volcanoes, Peter, what a fun topic.
I mean, it's a great topic. There's always a volcano active somewhere in this world. And then you think about how volcanoes affect not only our landscape, but our climates and the environment around the world.
Well, and even though, you know, a volcano is not actively going off right now in Idaho, here living in the southern part of the state, it doesn't take much driving around to find evidence for very recent volcanism in our region. And so it's pretty exciting to get a chance to talk to Dr. Scott Hughes here, who can tell us more about why we have so much activity in the middle of the continent, which is kind of an interesting thing. We'll get to that in a little bit. But first, you know what? Let's have some nature news, Peter.
For most of my life, 45 plus years, there's been one magic trick that has stymied me, and that's the wiggly rubber pencil trick, where you grab the pencil at the end and you shake it up and down and it looks like it's bending.
Looks like it's bending. Yes, I know that.
Right. Yeah. And that's been vexing me for a long time until now.
Until now.
The simple explanation for this phenomenon, it deals with our eyes and our brain. We cannot keep up with the movement of that pencil.
So it's moving too fast?
It's moving too fast. And so how our eyes and brain kind of work together, the eyes, in a sense, take a picture. And then that picture gets sent off to our brain, and our brain is compiling all these individual pictures like a Super 8 film. And we actually aren't seeing things in live time. We're about a millisecond behind what we're actually seeing. And so when that pencil's moving up and down, our brain and our eyes can't keep up with that movement. And it kind of blurs it all together to make it look like the pencil's bending. However, if you were a bird, they can process these images with their brain significantly faster. They wouldn't see a bendy pencil. They would just see a line going up and down.
Interesting. Now, how would you know that about a bird?
I'm not sure. I was just reading this. The other thing I found out is that fluorescent lights flicker. And if we were a bird, we would notice the lights flickering.
We'd be very annoyed by it.
We'd be very, very annoyed by it. That's the simple explanation. Well, we've got some researchers who've decided, because it's science, we've got to go a little bit further. And they decided to test if we, as a test subject, kind of move our eyes in a different pattern. They were hoping that we could process that pencil image a little bit quicker and be like a bird and see a line.
Okay.
And what they found out, however, was that we can sort of do that. It's still kind of bendy and wiggly. We just couldn't get to that line like the image with the birds until on a computer simulation they drew a box around that line. And as soon as they drew a box around that line, our brains were able to process a straight line like the birds. And it comes down to perspective.
Go on.
We had that box kind of put that line in perspective. It separated that image out. And so you weren't seeing it blend together.
Oh, I see. So, and maybe even the straight line gave you some context to compare the straightness of the pencil next to it.
Yep.
Right? What do we take from this?
Our eyes can fool us, right? And our brains can fool us as well.
Our brains can fool us.
Yeah.
But there might be some tricks to overcome.
Really, we live our lives in context. Everything we do has to be put in context, huh?
Surely. And we don't have the fastest brains out there either.
No, not one bit.
Not even close. I kind of feel good about this, and I don't feel kind of good about this. I'm not sure how to take it.
Well, I look at it as we've got ways to improve.
Well, that's a positive out. Well, today we're going to be talking volcanoes. Our trivia question today, of course, in Idaho, what is the youngest lava flow in Idaho? I think you'll be surprised by the answer to that. We'll be right back after this break with Dr. Scott Hughes. He's going to join us to talk about volcanoes in Idaho, and he's going to answer that question for us.
Get continued access to local news and all the programs you enjoy through the Listen Live link at KISU.org. Or try using your web-connected Amazon or Google smart speaker with the command Play KISU.
Hey, welcome back from the break. I want to welcome today's guest, Dr. Scott Hughes. He's an emeritus professor of Geology at Idaho State University, and he's an expert on volcanoes. So first off, thank you for joining us today on The Nature of Idaho.
I'm really glad to be here, and I always enjoy listening to various shows on public radio, and it's great to be talking to you right now.
Well, Scott, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to become a guy focused on volcanoes?
I think kids are interested in four things: dinosaurs, space, insects, and volcanoes. I was one of those kids that I was always interested in dinosaurs and volcanoes, and so sort of settled in on volcanoes. But I was really interested in space when my dad took me out when I was 7 years old and showed me Sputnik going over late at night. And so ever since then, all those things that sort of gnawed at my brain have led me towards the field of volcanology. Geology was one of those things I didn't even think about. But when I sat in on my first geology class, I just got hooked. From that point on, going on to grad school and undergraduate in geology. In grad school, I did my master's degree work in northern Arizona, mapped out a volcanic field around Bill Williams Mountain, south of there, and then went on to work on a PhD at Oregon State, which I did work in the High Cascades. What's really important about this, though, is that I started focusing more of my efforts on not just volcanoes in general, but mainly on basaltic systems. And basaltic systems, the mafic platform of the High Cascades was my mainstay of work in the 80s when I was in grad school and early 80s. And then I got to work on moon rocks. I analyzed a bunch of moon rocks from both the Luna and the Apollo missions. And of course, the moon is a lot of basalt on the moon. And so this whole idea of looking at volcanoes, where they exist on Earth and where they exist on other planetary bodies, is always a fascination for me for the last several decades. And then when I finally got to Idaho, it's like, wow, here are basalts everywhere. But there are other ones, other forms of volcanism too. And as a person who is passionate about basalt, I found out that, well, of course, there are these other types of volcanic systems, and the derivatives of basaltic systems are really what is necessary to understand. Because basically, all the volcanic systems we have in Idaho are based primarily on the origin of basaltic magma.
Tell us more about basalt. So you've said this word, and some of our listeners will know what that means, but describe for us what that rock looks like so we can relate.
Well, black lava. Basalt is essentially what you say, black lava. However, basalt is also a chemical term, a basalt composition. And if you take the bulk composition of the Earth, represented, say, by the mantle of the Earth, and if you partially melt it, you will get something like a basaltic magma. So the primordial magmas that we get from 80 to 100 kilometers depth are essentially basalts. And these basaltic magmas rise into the lower crust, for example, or into the lithosphere. And because they are hot, they melt out other forms of the crust or other parts of the crust to produce derivative compositions. Or we have what's called fractionation that can produce derivative compositions. The point here, though, is that basalts are rich in iron and magnesium, not as enriched in, say, sodium or potassium. Basalts, like most rocks or most volcanic rocks, have a lot of silicon and aluminum and titanium. But basalts in particular are enriched in iron and magnesium, which gives them that particularly dark color.
Within volcanic systems, basalt is not the only type of magma that we find.
Absolutely. But a lot of these various types are derived ultimately from a basaltic parent. Because the basaltic parent has evolved over various forms by either assimilating something else or by what we call fractional crystallization. I like to use this analogy. You take a big trash can full of, let's say, rice, corn, steel pellets. And if you shake it up enough, the heavy stuff's going to fall to the bottom. The light stuff's going to rise to the top. And this is what happens in a magmatic system. A little more complex than that, but it's kind of what happens. A magma will actually drop out certain types of minerals, like olivine is a really good example, a very dense mineral, but it's also magnesium rich and iron rich in some cases. But if something is magnesium rich and it falls out, then the lava that's left over, the magma that's left over, is lower and lower in magnesium and higher in things like sodium and potassium. So this is what's called fractionation. You're actually changing the ratios of one element to another. And by doing that, just in the evolutionary process of a magma, we're getting different compositions. And so, for example, the rhyolite domes out on the Snake River Plain, they're rhyolite. They're higher in sodium and potassium and much lower in magnesium and iron. They were derived by, essentially, evolution from a basalt.
And those rhyolite domes, that's a different kind of lava. It has a much lighter color. And that's a way to tell those kinds of rocks apart.
Exactly. But not only a different color, the magma itself, as it's ascending, much more viscous, higher viscosity, and so it's really sluggish, more strength. And so when a volcano like that erupts, perhaps the magma is so strong that as it's trying to expand, forming bubbles, and the bubbles are trying to grow, the expansion of those bubbles is going to cause minor explosions, little tiny pops. And you get a bazillion of these pops going on, and you have an ash in the air, like Mount St. Helens. And as magma moves up, it continues to pop and blow off. The gas that's emitted forces the particles, which are mainly little glass shards and bits and pieces of crystals and other maybe other rocks, blows them up and forces them out of the vent. A rhyolitic eruption might produce an ash cloud like that, but underneath that eruption, there could be what's called a subvolcanic intrusion. The same magma is down there crystallizing in place, and left is something kind of solid. The buttes on the Snake River Plain, they didn't have much of that explosiveness, but they did force their way up and ooze out in a very sluggish manner, so they become very steep-sided and tall.
Let's talk about the Snake River Plain, because I think a lot of the discussion we could have about why there are volcanoes in Idaho really can link back to what formed and is forming the Snake River Plain today. Could you tell us about that history?
To get an idea of Idaho volcanoes, you'd have to go back about 18, 20 million years, back when Yellowstone hotspot, if you will, began over in eastern Oregon, southern Washington, northern Nevada, and southwestern Idaho. There's a complicated scenario of subduction, extension, and rise of a mantle plume. And as that mantle plume impinged upon the lithosphere in that region, the whole landscape bulged upwards and ultimately started producing rhyolitic volcanoes. And those rhyolitic volcanoes were like the ones we see in Yellowstone today, but they were down in southwest Idaho in that region, what's called the Owyhee region. Those volcanoes produced a lot of ash. Ash flows and ash fall out. And so these ignimbrite units were characterized on either side of what is now the Snake River Plain. But that whole system, as it rose up, a bulge in the lithosphere produced a series of volcanoes like Yellowstone, but it also was a high point in the continent, and that was where the continental divide was at that time. And as Idaho and the North American plate went over this big, massive plume, the continental divide shifted eastward. And so where you are sitting right now in Pocatello, Idaho, the continental divide was probably right there with you about 10 million years ago. And since then, volcanism has moved east, northeastward towards Yellowstone. And by the time it got up to the Yellowstone area now, that was about 2 million years ago. Now, what has happened during that time? I mentioned that basalt is a driving force, and basaltic magmatism is a driving force of a lot of this. So during that time, after the Yellowstone hotspot has passed on, we still have a lot of eruption and emplacement of magma into the crust. And that magma is basaltic magma, and it's very dense, and as it crystallizes, it makes gabbro, but it also is capable of producing more eruptions. So what happened here was that huge amount of gabbro, and it's like a big, heavy slab that's right in the Snake River Plain, and they just dragged the crust down. As it dragged the crust down, the plain was formed. And so the plain is not a big erosional feature. It's a big structural feature that now has the Snake River flowing through it. And then after all these Yellowstone volcanics were dragged down with it, basalts came along and started piling up on top. So we have a thin layer of basalt lava flows that are covering the Snake River Plain in the wake of the Yellowstone hotspot. And every now and then, you might have a renewed eruption of a silicic system like Big Southern Butte. Big Southern Butte or East Butte, the buttes out there, which are rhyolite domes, and they poke their way up through the basalts and are exposed on the surface. Some of them didn't quite make it all the way through, like Middle Butte. It pushes way up through the basalt, but it still has a basalt cap. You can't see the light-colored rhyolite, you know, under the basalt cover, but it's still part of the system. What that does is it makes the Snake River Plain have what's called a bimodal system. Bimodal meaning basalt on one end of the compositional spectrum and then rhyolite on the other end of the compositional spectrum. But the story doesn't stop there because there are so many intermediate type compositions of like Craters of the Moon. Craters of the Moon is totally different than most of the other basalts on the Snake River Plain. They're not true basalts anyway. They're other compositions. There's a striking difference between not only the eruptive style at Craters of the Moon, but their overall composition as well. Different from the kind of basalts that we see on the surface of the Snake River Plain now, represented by Hellsap Acre, Wapai, and so forth.
When we're looking at these basalt lava flows, are they coming from that traditional mountain structure, or are they just kind of coming out of the ground?
That's a really good question, because a lot of people, when they think of a volcano, they think of the quintessential volcanic structure of a nice stratocone, which is snow-capped, and it's got a crater at the top and all that. No. The volcanoes are the most prevalent volcanoes on the Snake River Plain, at least, were produced during an extensional system. The Yellowstone hotspot, for example, is sort of emplaced over the basin and range extension. And this extensional system allowed for a reduction in pressure. And so when these basaltic magmas are erupting, they're erupting through fissures. And the fissures are more like Hawaiian eruptions, where they don't produce big, tall stratovolcanoes like Mount St. Helens or Rainier. They're more like small shield volcanoes and fissures with spatter eruptions. These fissures, which can be hundreds of meters to several kilometers long, would produce basalt lava. And as that lava flowed out, it piled up and piled up and piled up. And so when we think of a volcano in Idaho on the Snake River Plain, these are very low, very broad, low profile, and they're actually called low shields. But they're monogenetic. They erupt once and then they don't erupt again. But the whole Snake River Plain is covered with these shields that have been intercalating like a whole bunch of pancakes thrown out at random. They're all over the place.
Let's talk about one of the easily accessible pancakes. I like that metaphor. We have one that we drive through here on the eastern part of the state when you drive on I-15 north from Pocatello through Blackfoot and then up to Idaho Falls. We pass through Hell's Half Acre. There's a nice roadside rest area where you can get out, and there's a nice little walking path that walks you right through those basalts. Can you tell us about Hell's Half Acre, and is that a typical type of basalt deposit that we find along the Snake River?
Yes, it is typical. It's one of the typical Snake River Plain olivine tholeite type of basalt. The interesting thing about that rest area is that on both sides, you can take a trail. And they have a little nature trail you can walk on. When you're on that trail, one thing you can observe is that there are a lot of pits and hummocks. Lava flows like that don't just flow out like hot fudge down a plate. It actually flows from within. The lobes that you see are inflationary, whereas you get a surface crust that's formed and the lava is actually moving within. You could actually even walk on a lava flow like that while it's still active. And maybe if you stood long enough, you'd feel yourself rise up with it just because of that inflationary mechanism. That inflationary mechanism produces hummocks and pits and, you know, where it doesn't inflate, and also a lot of areas where it collapses too. So there is a lot to see there at Hell's Half Acre. And realizing that it's only 5,000 years old, which is young in terms of geology time, not the youngest on the plain, though, but certainly because it's not so old and because Idaho is blessed with a climate that's not too conducive to a lot of weathering, you know, you can still see a lot of these features firsthand and fresh. And I would encourage anybody that's interested in volcanology or geology in general, just take one of those little walks and see for yourself and try to understand how things are working.
Yeah, I've driven by Hell's Half Acre 100 times since I've moved here, and I've never stopped to walk around. And it's just right there. It's so close. It sounds insanely cool.
If you're really interested, go on to the north side of Hillsap Acre. There's a little parking area up there, well, west of Idaho Falls, and you can hike from there to the actual eruptive center of Hillsap Acre. And you'll see that the crater at the center, or where the eruption occurred, it's not a big, tall, spiry thing. You know, it is a hole in the ground. It's a huge area where the central part of the eruption collapsed. And these big collapsed pit craters and filled back up with lava and then maybe drained away again and filled back up and drained away. So all this very low viscosity lava, it starts to form what's called a little bit elevated summit region. But the summit region is barely detectable in some cases.
So, Scott, do we in Idaho need to put together a volcano eruption safety kit anytime soon? Are we still active in Idaho?
I don't think you need an eruption safety kit. That would be like trying to build a lightning protection kit when you know what to do when there's a lightning storm. The Snake River Plain, I consider it to be an active system. But an active system means it will erupt again, most likely. Who knows when? It could erupt in the next 100 years or 1,000 years or whatever. But even though it's an active system, we don't need to worry too much about it because, number one, the lava flows that are produced on the Snake River Plain, the lava eruptions, are not so violent that they are going to produce huge clouds of ash that are going to just wreak havoc on everyone. But they also occur once every 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 years. The most recent eruptions on the Snake River Plain were about 2,000 years ago. And it doesn't mean that we have another 1,000 years to wait. It's just that the hiatus between eruptions can be as long as several thousand years. But that said, the main difference here is that low viscosity eruptions, like those in the Snake River Plain and Hawaii, and now the one even in Iceland that's going off, they are not so explosive that they can produce violent eruptions that would wreak havoc. Now, if Yellowstone went off again, that would be a different story. Don't ever say you're absolutely safe. You can say most likely. One time, a few years ago, I took a bunch of planetary scientists out on the Snake River Plain. They said, well, should we worry about rattlesnakes? And I said, you know, I've worked out on the plain a lot, and I've only seen maybe one or two rattlesnakes. In 4 days, we saw three. And I had to eat a lot of crow. So,
can you tell us about the connection between the volcanic history and processes and the things that we can observe here in Idaho and how researchers are allowed to make a connection to other planetary bodies, whether it's the moon or Mars?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, first of all, back when we were starting to explore other planets, there are some very good geologists, one of them named Ron Greeley out of Arizona State, and Mel Koontz has worked a lot on the Snake River Plain as well, mapping and so forth. And there have been others too. But the main thing is that these people that work started out there on the plain started recognizing that the features that we see are reminiscent of similar features that we see on other planets. And so we find out that a basaltic fissure eruption on Earth might be similar to a basaltic fissure eruption on the moon or Mars or Mercury or any other planetary body that has basalts. But more to the point, a lot of researchers since then have begun studying the shapes, the sizes, and the compositions, when the composition can be understood, and the overall physiography in order to understand the nature of them. We use these studies, they're called analog studies. By studying and understanding what has occurred on Earth, we can understand more about how they exist and why they exist on other planets. So as it turns out, the Snake River Plain is actually the type area for a particular style of eruption that occurs on other planets. It's called plain-style volcanism, which was coined by Ron Greeley back in the 70s. And plain-style volcanism is a style that's sort of intermediate between Hawaiian and Strombolian. Strombolian eruptions produce cinder cones, and Hawaiian eruptions produce, you know, spatter cones and broad lava flows. But something in between that would be more like plains volcanism, where we have these, well, coalescing shield volcanoes, one here, one there, one over here, and they occur one at a time and sort of lap onto each other. And so we find out that kind of volcanic system has occurred on Mars, for example. And we find out there are low shields on Mars. They're much older than the ones on Earth, but there are definitely low shields on Mars, and they look a whole lot like the ones we find on Earth, and in similar size and shape, too.
That's fantastic. The ability to, again, make those linkages between things that are happening here in our backyard and then something that's happening, you know, on another planet entirely. That's very exciting.
We actually just finished a survey of basaltic fissures, and it just got published. Publication just came out just a few weeks ago. It was actually published back in November about basaltic fissure eruptions. We use the Snake River Plain as a type area for categorizing some of these things. And we find out that doing the same kind of a survey all over the Earth to look at different types of fissures, after cataloging them on Earth, and this is via the Smithsonian. The Smithsonian website has a huge database of volcanoes on Earth. We started looking at the systems on the Moon and Mars, which might have the same types of fissures. And certainly we found that there are differences, but there are similarities in a way of being able to categorize those basaltic fissures that we see on the Moon and on Mars. So knowing what's on Earth and being able to use them as analogs, and especially places like the Snake River Plain, we can then start exploring to see if we can find similar systems that exist on other planetary bodies.
Appreciate you talking to us about volcanoes today. You need to help us out with our trivia question, which I think, if you were paying attention, might have been mentioned, but not specifically. So can you help us? What is the youngest lava flow in Idaho, and where would you find it?
The youngest lava flow in Idaho is really a toss-up in terms of, if you think about which happened last. There was an eruption at Craters of the Moon and an eruption at Wapai, and an eruption at King's Bowl. Those three have been dated using radiocarbon dating at about 2,200 years ago. And so you can say, okay, roughly 2,000 years ago was the last eruption on the Snake River Plain. Within analytical uncertainty, they're all about the same. So it's not really fair to say which one was the youngest, but we can say that Craters of the Moon, Wapai, and King's Bowl all share that age range.
Excellent.
That's awesome. Scott, we really want to thank you for visiting today with us about volcanoes. And really, to learn more about volcanoes in Idaho, please visit the USGS website or go out and visit Craters of the Moon or Hell's Half Acre near Blackfoot. They're right here, easy to get to.